Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon. Welcome along. I'm Justin Brierley, and this is Unbelievable, the show that aims to get you thinking every Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio and listen to around the world via our podcast at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And there you'll find links to the YouTube channel as well, where today's show is also available and brought to you once again from lockdown, recording this in my home as the whole show has been today. So if you hear any bangs, thuds or shouts in the background, it's probably my children who are roaming around as we speak. It's a challenge, I will say that, keeping the show going, the job going, lots of other things that we're doing at Premier Christian Radio. My wife's in full-time ministry and there's children on the scene, but hey, it's the same for everyone right now, isn't it? So wherever you are, however you're listening or watching the show today, I do hope you're doing well, keeping safe, and enjoy what I've got lined up for you today. And that is a fascinating discussion on God, Stephen Hawking, and the multiverse. I'll be introducing my guests in a short moment's time. Normally, this last week, I would have been at Spring Harvest down in Minehead giving some talks and lectures on apologetics. But of course, that hasn't been able to go ahead. All of the Spring Harvest events had to be cancelled for this year, but they were still able to put on Spring Harvest Home on their YouTube channel. And there's loads of great content if you want to go and check out the Spring Harvest YouTube channel, including a couple of talks that I was able to give. I'll talk about those a little bit later on in the show, and I'm sure we'll also feature them on the Unbelievable YouTube channel and indeed here on the podcast at some point as well, because this coronavirus crisis has given me opportunity to put out some extra bits and pieces as well. Towards the end of today's show, we'll hear some of your feedback as well on recent editions of the programme, the Easter special that we had debating the resurrection, also some of your thoughts on some of the recent content we've put out from John Lennox. A special video as well from William Lane Craig. I sat down to talk to him over Zoom recently, putting that out on the Unbelievable YouTube channel this weekend, and you'll probably find it on our social media as well. If you want to follow us via Facebook, it's Unbelievable JB is what you're looking for, or just type in Unbelievable with a question mark on Facebook. YouTube, it's at Unbelievable JB. You can find me on Instagram at justin.brierley. But for the moment, let's get into today's edition of the program.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, today on the show, we're discussing God, Stephen Hawking, and the multiverse. That's the title of a new book by David Hutchings and David Wilkinson that traces how Stephen Hawking changed the way we think about the universe and how his ideas have shaped the conversation about God, science, and where everything came from. David Hutchings is a physics teacher from York. He's written several books about the relationship between science and religion, and he came on this show a couple of years ago, probably now, Dave, with Tom McLeish at the time to do a similar sort of discussion. David Wilkinson is principal of St. John's College, Durham University, where he's professor of theology and religion. Also a former guest on this show. I think, David, it was when you wrote your book on extraterrestrial life and that kind of thing. And it was
really
interesting discussion. And you're an ordained minister, David. You have a background, though, in astrophysics, PhD. You write and speak widely, obviously, on Christianity and science. And Phil Halper comes back to the show as well. It's all former guests of one sort or another. Phil, as our skeptical atheist guest today, runs the YouTube channel Skydive Phil, where he has interviewed many of the leading physicists in the world on cosmology and astrophysics, including Stephen Hawking, actually, before he passed away in 2018. And Phil's taken a personal interest over the years in the dialogue between Christianity and physics, as he thinks that scientific theories often been wrongly interpreted or misused by Christians to lend weight to the God hypothesis. So today we're going to be asking what space Stephen Hawking's theories about singularities, quantum mechanics and the universe actually left for God, and whether contemporary physics is a friend or foe of the notion of a divine creator. So welcome everyone from our various spare rooms in lockdown for today's edition of Unbelievable. Great to see you all. Let's start with Dave and David. Give us a sense of this book. First of all, Dave, you're a physics teacher. First of all, I guess life in lockdown means, school was out early, but it must be a bit of a challenge teaching your students remotely at the moment.
Yeah, it was a lot harder doing it from my office on a laptop than it is in a lab, when you can actually pull pieces of equipment out of cupboards and demonstrate things, or turn around to a giant whiteboard and start jotting down ideas. So learning to do that just on a live chat with 20 teenagers, especially when they discover that they can put memes and GIFs and pictures in you're trying to explain something, is interesting.
A flood of emojis, yes, as you're trying to explain particle physics or something. Good to have you on the show today, Dave. And David Wilkinson, you've obviously facing similar issues with no students on site currently at Durham University.
That's right, no students on site in a college which was built for students, and the whole philosophy of bringing different subjects together into conversation. But we're having those conversations online, we're doing teaching online, and I find myself in the surreal experience of talking about Stephen Hawking from my son's former bedroom. He got married last summer, moved out, but I have to say the smell didn't move out.
Okay.
That's still here. So
I'm glad the technology hasn't advanced enough for us to have smells as well in that case. Phil, welcome along to the program as well. Another person broadcasting from some room in their house. Lockdown for you. You're a jet setter, so I can imagine you can't go on all those interesting parts of the world that you're
not. No, we had a trip booked to Chernobyl, and that would have been a safer place than here, maybe. None of that. No, but we've had very clear skies, so I've had the telescope out a lot, and that's
been, and I hope we'll get to see some of those pictures in a little moment. But before we see some of that, David and Dave, tell us about why you decided to write a book on God, Stephen Hawking, and the multiverse. Dave, would you like to kick us off?
When Hawking died in 2018, I think that it gives you a chance to really think about what someone has done, what they've achieved. A lot of newspapers and magazines and TV programming looking at the massive impact that he had, who he was as a person, but also the ideas that he came up with. I was approached by a publisher, having already written a popular level science book with another academic, to consider writing a book about Hawking's life and his work. And I said, well, why don't you ask David Wilkinson, who I knew via other connections, because when I was a teenager, and I really do want to make that point again, when I was a teenager, I got this book, God, Time and Stephen Hawking, written by David Wilkinson. So I thought, well, he's got to be the guy to do it, right? He's done this before. When David was approached, he said, well, why don't we do it together? And that's what's happened. I think that the teaching job really is, or part of teaching, is to go and get stuck into the complicated ideas and listen to the experts, and then think, right, how do you present this to people who are not experts? And I think it's quite similar to what Phil does in a lot of ways.
We try to do through the Unbelievable show as well.
Yeah, we're often trying to
distill big ideas into kind of something that's accessible for a wide audience. And I think you really have done that actually with this book. And I know Phil's going to disagree with some aspects of it, but I have to say for myself, you will come away knowing a lot more if you didn't know much about this area before, in a way that's comprehensible as well, which I think in itself is a great achievement. David, I mean, you actually obviously have met Stephen Hawking. You've followed, obviously, his career. We've kind of got this media image of him, obviously, which was, you know, increased by that film that came out, Theory of Everything, detailing his life and so on. Why has he been such a hugely significant popular public figure during the whole of his life?
Well, yes, and thank you, Dave, for reminding me just how old I am in terms of you reading something that I'd written when you were a teenager. That's a very helpful reminder. My own interest in Hawking's work goes back to when I was doing my own PhD in astrophysics. And I was at a conference when A Brief History of Time came out. And although I worked on the helium abundance in Big Bang cosmology, I never worked in the area that Professor Hawking was. But I was fascinated by the, not just the big science, the big thinking, the taking on of some of the things that other physicists would leave behind, but also how it was being interpreted in the media. And Carl Sagan, in his foreword to Brief History of Time, said, this is a book about God, or perhaps about the absence of God. Well, I was a young Christian doing a PhD in physics at the time, and therefore, I was fascinated by that intersection. I was interested in the science, and I was interested in what that meant for faith. And I remember having a late-night conversation with Sir Robert Boyd, one of the great founders of British space science, who himself was a Christian, and saying to him, you know, is there something that we need to worry about in terms of Hawking's approach? And he said, no. He said, I don't fully understand what it's about, but he said, the God that I believe in is a God of the whole universe, not to be confined just at the beginning. And if there's a scientific way of describing the very first moments of the universe, then we shouldn't be worried about that. And so it was, I think, because of the science, I think because of the theology. And as you rightly say, Justin, he became a superstar. I know that because he appeared on The Simpsons and he appeared on Star Trek The Next Generation. And even Specsaver adverts. That's a real test of being a superstar, yeah, I think, in absolutely. Western culture. And there was something about his own personal life story, the courage, the disability, the illness, woven through these big questions in a way that was just intriguing and fascinating and challenging.
Well, it's a very, you know, suitable time to bring a book out like this. And the area that we're looking into changes all the time. There are always new theories being developed. And Hawking himself obviously changed his mind, you know, on various things over the decades. And we'll maybe get a kind of brief history, if you'll forgive the pun, of some of his greatest hits, if you like, through the 60s, 70s and 80s. But let's introduce Phil to the program. Phil runs a great YouTube channel. And Phil, tell us sort of where this all began for you, because I think to some extent it was kind of engaging actually with the Christian philosophical apologetics type discussions and the way they were using science that kind of prompted you to go out and start to really investigate as a layperson some of these theories and sort of try and present these films that kind of make them accessible to the general public.
Right. Well, I started out because I've always been fascinated by cosmology, and who can't be fascinated by the origin of the universe? I mean, I think that's impossible. And I knew there were a whole bunch of interesting theories, and I wanted to learn more about them. And it's hard to do because either stuff is too dumbed down or it's too technical. And there's very little in between. And so I thought, well, there'll be some material on YouTube. I was interested. The first film we made in cosmology was about a rival to string theory called loop quantum gravity and loop quantum cosmology. And there was so little about it that those guys were not very good at publicizing themselves. So I thought, well, I'll find something on YouTube. And there wasn't anything. And eventually someone said to me, if you want to watch it, why don't you make it? And so that's what happened. And it just snowballed from there.
Yeah. Do you want to sort of, I mean, fair to say at this point that you probably had one of the last interviews with Stephen Hawking that he gave. Just explain how that came about, because arranging an interview with Stephen Hawking was no mean feat. What was involved in actually making that happen?
So we basically had made a few films in this series called Before the Big Bang about competing models of the early universe. And I think the one that we had done before that was the one I was on the show to discuss last time I was on the show, which was with Alan Guth, who invented inflationary cosmology. And so I think that attracted Stephen's team. And I worked with not just Stephen Hawking, but Jim Hartle and Thomas Hertog, who are key people in his sort of circle. And they were impressed with that film with Alan Guth. So they basically let the guard down and said, yeah, okay, you can come and talk to Stephen.
Yeah. Why don't we just see a little clip from one of the recent films, and that'll give a sense of the sort of people you're talking to and the kinds of subjects that you're discussing. Let's watch that now.
It is certainly a view quite commonly expressed now that we shouldn't simply give up that the Big Bang is a singularity, that we need a theory which describes that. Most people will say it's a form of quantum gravity. I have a view which is different from that, but nevertheless, I have in common with that that we need a new theory.
The real lesson of the singularity theorems is therefore that we need to combine the general theory of relativity with quantum theory in order to understand the origin of the universe.
I don't think anybody believes that the universe started off with the singularity. That just tells us that Einstein's classical theory of general relativity breaks down. So that classical theory of gravity doesn't apply when you get to very high energies. So it's replaced by some quantum theory, consistent quantum theory of gravity. String theory is a candidate for a theory like this.
There you go, a clip, and I do encourage you to head over to Phil's channel. I'll make sure there's a link, obviously, from the podcast info and here at the YouTube channel as well, if you're watching. Let's come back to the book, and then I'd be really interested to see what Phil's reactions are to it. Obviously, we're going to have to do this in a very thumbnail way, Dave and David, but give us a brief overview. Maybe I'll start with you, Dave, for this one, of some of the big things that Hawking did through his life, some of the big speculative theories that he put out there, and where you think he got it right, where you think maybe it's a lot more debatable whether, you know, those sorts of theories are the thing. And maybe I'll then come to David for sort of the theological ramifications of what those theories have done. But you give us the science, if you like, first of all, if you would, Dave.
Sure. Well, Hawking's life was a sort of love affair with gravity, really, or love and hate affair, I suppose. What's fascinating about gravity is that, of course, everybody knows about it. Everybody knows that things fall. You don't have to tell even a young child that. But it wasn't written down mathematically until Isaac Newton did it. And even when he did that, which was a huge breakthrough, and he was able to come up with some equations that described it, he still had no idea what the mechanism was. So he actually writes in Principia, I leave it up to the interested reader to try and figure out why my equations work. I know that they do, but I don't know why. And then you skip forward a couple of centuries and up turns Albert Einstein, and Einstein comes up with this mechanism, which I think most people have probably seen in one form or another, that what gravity is really doing is bending space. So the presence of mass bends the space around it, or the space-time around it, but I'm sure we can get into that later. And when Hawking begins his PhD, we're working in this realm of Einstein's gravity, of bendy space. And one of the things that had turned up in these theories were black holes. Black holes were this idea that, a star could collapse inwards on itself. And as it does that, it gets denser and denser and denser. And that makes its own gravity stronger in those, more concentrated. That pulls it in more. That makes its gravity stronger. That pulls it in more. And you get a feedback loop. And these black holes would end up at the end of them having these infinities. You get to a point of infinite density or infinite curvature of space. And that was worked out by Roger Penrose, who was one of the guests you saw on the video earlier. They're called the singularity theorems, and Penrose showed that a collapsing black hole would always end up in a singularity. And what Hawking did in the mid-1960s in his PhD thesis is to say, well, if something that's collapsing in space-time ends up as a singularity, then what happens if something is growing in space-time? And by that point, there was a pretty convincing theory around that the universe was expanding. So Hawking said, well, I can think of the universe as being like a black hole collapse in reverse. It's expanding, it's growing. And if when black holes collapse, they collapse into singularities, then the universe must have expanded out of a singularity. So that was his PhD thesis. He stuck a singularity at the beginning of the universe and then spent the rest of his life trying to get rid of it again, along with everybody else. He's not the only person who's perhaps spent the rest of their life trying to undo their student years, but he did it professionally. And then in the 1970s, another breakthrough achievement was that he managed to get two theories, this theory called general relativity of how gravity behaves, and the theory of quantum mechanics, which is the theory of how the other three forces in nature behave. Well, normally those two theories don't play nice. They're mortal enemies. And when you put them in the same room, it's not very long before they're smacking each other about the head a bit. And this has been a big problem now for 100 years. We still haven't solved it. It's one of the things that Phil makes his video series on. You know, how do we get these two theories to play nice? And by the way, Phil, nice to meet you. And
nice to meet you too.
I can recommend the videos. As a science teacher, I watch a lot of YouTube videos about physics, and 90%+ of them I wouldn't let anywhere near any of my students. But I think yours are superb, and I really, really enjoyed them.
Thank you.
So keep making them.
Thank you.
In 1975, Hawking managed to get one of the ideas of quantum mechanics, which is particles popping in and out of existence, and one of the ideas in general relativity, which is black holes, to sit alongside each other, to behave well together. And he was using some of the wave mechanics ideas of quantum mechanics and some of the space-time ideas in general relativity. And instead of it all blowing up and instead of it all going wrong, he managed to get a consistent theory that would say that black holes should be emitting radiation, which we now call Hawking radiation. And when he looked at what Hawking radiation would look like, it turned out to be this incredibly recognizable shape that any physicist, even in the late 1800s, would have recognized. And although we haven't directly observed Hawking radiation yet, most physicists are pretty convinced that it's a sound theory. So Hawking's big achievement was getting general relativity and quantum mechanics to play ball. And then in the 1980s, his third really significant breakthrough. And again, I think one that gives a picture of his willingness to just think a little bit further or a little bit bigger than anybody else would, was to take something called a quantum mechanical wave function, which are these horrendously complicated equations that are normally designed to handle single atoms. So it would even take the entire screen to write out the equations for a hydrogen atom, the simplest atom that we have. And we wouldn't know, for example, how to write down the wave function for a tennis ball. But Hawking said, well, I'm going to write down the wave function for the entire universe. And so, again, you see this willingness to just go where other people wouldn't go and think in a way that other people had written off already. And so in the 1980s, with Jim Hartle, who's another one that Phil's worked with, they wrote down this paper called The Wave Function of the Universe. So you've got the singularity at the beginning in the 60s, you've got Hawking radiation in the 70s, and then you've got this idea in the 1980s of the wave function of the entire universe. Mm. And they are incredible achievements. So when Brian Cox said that we'll still be talking about Hawking's work in 1,000 years, it wasn't just one of those things that you say that's nice about someone who's died. I think he really meant it, and we're still talking about it now. I imagine there'll be plenty more to come. Yeah.
Well, obviously that gives us, you know, probably enough material to fill several shows. We'll see what we can get to in the course of the program. But of course, we also want to talk about the ramifications for the God question as well. And in a way, by the end of his life, at least, Hawking was just as well known for, you know, the sorts of things he was saying in his books about God as he was for the physics. So David, you know, I remember when The Grand Design came out, which was really his last book published while he was alive. He said some things along the lines of, look, physics is dead, and what I've been able to show...
Philosophy
is dead. And that there's clearly no need for a creator God once we look at the science behind the beginning of the universe and so on. To what extent, you know, do you think he got that right or wrong? And how was that actually played out? I suppose sometimes the media tends to make more of these things than there is in actual fact.
Yeah, I think for me, the kind of crucial moment for Professor Hawking was his report of a conference that he attended at the Vatican on cosmology, where the current Pope gave, John Paul II, gave an address at the end of this conference and said, or what Hawking reported the Pope said, was that science can only take you to a certain point in the history of the universe. It can't talk about the very beginning. At that point, that's where God comes in. Now, actually, the Pope didn't say that. Frank Tipler, another cosmologist, looked at the transcripts and said that isn't quite what the Pope said, but that's what Professor Hawking heard. And in a sense, he wanted to say, well, hold on a moment, that's not right. From that point on, Hawking began to think about the theological issues. Why can't science describe the very first moments of the universe? And so he used that exploration of both quantum theory and gravity that Davis so eloquently described to apply to the very first moment of the universe. Why do you need a God who starts off the universe? If the universe is a big explosion, then many religious people interpreted that kind of misshapen view of the Big Bang as a way to try and prove God. And Hawking said rightly, no, you don't need that. Why can't science describe the very first moments of the universe? Now, I think in Brief History of Time, he left the door open a little bit in terms of a belief in God. He certainly argued against a kind of God of the gaps who steps in and it has to be the cause of the universe. When he gets to the grand design and he introduces the concept of the multiverse, he's hardened up in his view of God and is much, much more forceful in saying there is no need at all for any kind of God in this. Now, to be honest, Justin, I've got a great deal of sympathy with Hawking's approach on this. It seems to me that it's never been part of Orthodox Christianity to try and prove God in some kind of logical or mathematical way. It's called the cosmological argument in temporal form, this kind of argument that who started the universe, it must be God. Now, Hawking's views, as we'll come on to, are still somewhat controversial. They don't convince every scientist and they don't give us the answer to every question. But in terms of his fundamental approach to say that science should be able to give descriptions or attempt to give descriptions of the physical universe, both as a physicist and as a theologian, I'm very sympathetic to that.
Okay. Well, that's a great way of teeing us up for the discussion today. And we obviously needed a bit of time to get into, you know, the whys and wherefores of the book and so on. So what we'll do is go to our first break and then we'll come back with Phil and we'll see what he made of the book and some of the areas that he would like to talk about as we look at the God, Stephen Hawking and the Multiverse. That's our discussion today. It's the title of the new book by David Hutchings and David Wilkinson, tracing the way that Stephen Hawking changed the way we think about the universe and what the implications are for the God conversation. So we'll be back very shortly with the second part of today's program.
The Unbelievable podcast has been hosting the conversation between Christians and skeptics for over a decade. They're sometimes friendly, sometimes feisty, but always fruitful, I hope, in helping you understand faith, reason, and culture. If you enjoy the show, please consider supporting it. It'll help me to continue to create these conversations that matter through video, podcast, and online resources. And as a thank you for any gift you give, we'll send you all of the video sessions from Unbelievable the Conference USA, featuring John Lennox, Mary Jo Sharp, Jay Warner Wallace, Brian Brodison, and others. To support the show, go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable and click on Give.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the second part of today's show. We're discussing God, Stephen Hawking, and the Multiverse. That's the title of a new book by David Hutchings and David Wilkinson. David Wilkinson is a physicist, theologian. David Hutchings, a physics teacher and author. And Phil Halper is my skeptical atheist guest on the show today, runs the YouTube channel Skydive Phil, where he puts out loads of interesting videos and interviews with leading cosmologists. And he's read the book. And Phil, be interested, first of all, on your overall response to the book. And then we'll start talking about some of the particulars that you maybe take issue with in the book. So what was your overall feel on this particular topic and book?
Well, mixed feelings. On the positive side, it's really well written, really engaging. It's entertaining in places. I think, as you said, that a lot of the science is very well explained. And when you come away, your knowledge will be increased. So there's a lot of good things to say about the book. On the negative side, I found that there was I felt misquoting of scientists, and a lot of the conclusions weren't supported by, some of the quotes that they actually had. So I don't know if you want me to just go into some of the particulars.
Well, why don't we start with sort of where Dave started, you know, back in the 1960s with singularities and so on, which to some extent is what Hawking is almost best known for, because I think it's the bit that's probably the most accessible of all of them. This idea that his research pointed towards this idea of this beginning phase of the universe coming out of this singularity and so on. And as Dave said, he spent the rest of his life trying to get rid of that conclusion in one way or another. So what was your issue with the way singularities is dealt with in this particular book?
Right. So they concluded, the two Daves concluded, that the singularities are probably real. And I think the vast majority of cosmologists would completely disagree with that. And it's okay to take a contrary position, but I think you should say you're taking a contrary position. What they said was that this is the mainstream view. And how they defended that was, first off, they agreed that the Penrose-Hawking theorem does not stand up. It's not likely to describe the world. And there are some technical reasons why that's true, but I think we should skip over those. But then they go on to the Bordet-Guth-Vilenkin theorem. Now, last time I was on the show, I'd interviewed Alan Guth, and he was very clear that theorem does not prove the universe has a beginning, does not prove there's a singularity. But Alex Vilenkin had in the past said that it does. So there's a conflict. So since then, I've interviewed Alex Vilenkin, and he basically now is with Guth. So to quote you, he said, let me see if I can find it. What is called the standard, this is Alex speaking now, what is called the standard Big Bang cosmology, which was the hot Big Bang, right? You start with a very hot, dense universe and begins at a singularity. So that picture, I don't think anybody believes. So that's kind of important. It's not just Alex and Alan don't think this is real. Alex is saying, and other people have said this, they don't think anybody believes it. And Alex said, and again, quoting him now, the theorem proves that inflation must have a beginning. The universe as a whole, it doesn't. The theorem doesn't say that. So inflation is this period of very rapid expansion. We talked about that the last time I was on the show. And what the theorem says is that that has a beginning, but that does not prove the universe has a beginning. So they also said textbooks have the singularity in them. Well, I have plenty of cosmology textbooks, and they all say the same thing. You can't trust the singularities. Nobody trusts them. What they are is signposts to new physics. So Stephen's great contribution in terms of singularities was creating that signpost. But it's not proving there was really a singularity. That is just not a view held by virtually anybody in the field.
I'd be interested, first of all, perhaps from Dave, and then we'll swap to David. What's at stake here with this singularity issue? Why... what do we lose if we don't have the singularity, in a sense that Phil believes that actually the majority of modern physicists don't actually believe exists in quite the way that you've perhaps suggested in the book?
Well, I think the problem with singularities is that they involve infinities, and when you have infinities, it's very hard to do any other maths. 3 times infinity is infinity. And so it's very hard to get any new information out. I think it would be fair to say that nobody really wants the singularity to be there because it's a science killer. I think also it's really important as well to point out that a lot of this stuff is, it's called theoretical physics for a reason. And things swing one way and the other. And we've tried to reflect that in the book. You know, I'll let David go into the science a little bit more. Where I have sympathy with Phil is that if he's been getting frustrated hearing Christians saying, the singularity is definitely there, and because of the singularity, there's a God, then I would say, well, that's frustrating to me as well. We went for probably, but a very, very gentle probably. I think the wording that we used was something along the lines of, let me see if I can find it. This is a wonderful glimpse of cutting-edge quantum cosmology. It's full of opinions and gut instincts and even emotion. This doesn't, of course, make it wrong, but it's a highly welcome reminder that quantum cosmologists are people too. We'd spoken to a decent number of people on the issue. I think it's still up in the air. We erred on the side of probably. I mean, Aaron Wall, who works in the office a couple of doors down from where Hawking worked, he did a long series of posts looking at all the different models out there. And he said, if you put all the physics information together, the conclusion I would draw is that we don't know for sure whether the universe began, but to the extent of our present day knowledge is an indicator, it probably did. He thinks that the singularity theorems might be extendable to quantum gravity. And then also John Barrow in 1994, way back in 1994, said one should be wary of the fact that many of the studies in quantum cosmology are motivated by the desire to avoid an initial singularity. We came down on the side of probably. If we'd come down on the side of probably not, I don't think it would have made any significant difference to the overall message of our book.
Okay.
And it's not something that I'm going to plant a flag in and say, part of my apostles, I'm going to insert a singularity into my apostles' creed. But I'll hand over to David.
Well, I'll come back to David in a moment. I'll just be interested in Phil's response to that. What we're saying here is that when it comes to whether there's a singularity at the beginning of the universe, Dave and David in the book said probably on the basis of what appears to be, you know, the consensus. Your view, Phil, is no, you don't think that is the consensus, actually. You think things are moved away from there being a consensus among physicists that there's a singularity. Is this just because this is a changing landscape and things change
It's not just that. So first off, the Penrose-Hawking theorems had an assumption in them. And that assumption was that gravity is always attractive. Well, once we saw that the universe is accelerating in its expansion, that assumption is known to be false. So then you have the Bode-Guthen-Vilenkin theorem. But that doesn't tell you there was a singularity. And in fact, Aaron Wall on his blog said explicitly it doesn't have the implication that there's a beginning to the universe. So I just don't see. So, but the thing is, it's fine to say our view is probably yes, there was a singularity. I mean, nobody knows, right? There could be, but what's the problem I have with is how they got to that probably yes. They said it was written in textbooks, but I don't think that's not what my textbooks say. They said the Bode-Guthen-Vilenkin theorem says that, but it doesn't. And then they quoted Aaron Wall. Now, Aaron Wall, in his quote, I think he was very honest. He said, "My view is that there probably will be something like the Penrose theorem, but other physicists don't agree." So if other physicists don't agree, then what justifies probably yes? I can't see.
Well, let's come to David. David, you know, you erred on the side of probably yes, there is a singularity at the beginning of the universe. Phil obviously feels like that's not where most scientists are these days in the field. What would you say in response?
I think Phil's got a point that there's a historical development going on. And what we've got is a number of people, as Dave said earlier, who want to find a way to avoid singularities. And I would be one of them myself. I've got sympathy with all of these views, which say there are ways to get away from singularities. And some of the quantum cosmologies and inflationary models allow us to do that. I think that's why I'm not wedded to singularities. I don't think there's any theological merit in a singularity. And I'm not going to defended very strongly. I think there is a language issue here, and that is that what we mean by beginning. Now, in one sense, beginnings are sometimes linked with causes, and sometimes beginnings are simply to say there was something and there wasn't something. Now, I think I'm of the view that our current consensus in terms of models is that you don't have to have a cause to have a temporal beginning to the universe. I mean, if that beginning is about the beginning of the inflationary process, that doesn't necessarily mean for me, either physically or theologically, that you need a cause. I think you can have an uncaused universe, which arises in a number of different ways. So when we talk about beginnings, we're not linking that to a singularity in order to say we need a cause, or at this point, as Hawking heard the Pope say, physics can't deal with it. And that's why a singularity is important.
I think the point, you know, obviously a lot of Christians and Christian apologists have, you know, jumped on the idea of a beginning of the universe and, you know, the potential implications, theistic implications of that. I mean, if say we were to say, you know, actually, we don't think, you know, that the science is pointing in that direction anymore or whatever. Where does that leave God for you, for instance, Dave? You know, some people might say, well, what role does God have at this point then, if God didn't start the whole show off, you know, if God isn't the cause of the universe? Does that mean, you know, that God is sort of made redundant effectively because the science has sort of said, no, well, actually, it turns out we don't need God, which is effectively kind of what Hawking was saying in The Grand Design. Or is that a naive way of thinking about the role of God when it comes to the universe and so on?
Well, for the vast majority of the church's history over the last 2,000 years, Aristotle's cosmology held, and that was that the universe was eternal. If you looked at the vast majority of Christians who have held some sort of faith in God or adhered to the Apostles' Creed, most of them would have at least been at peace with the idea of eternal universe if they were thinking about it much. Aquinas, he sort of breaks with Aristotle a bit. He likes Aristotle and he wants to take most of Aristotle's ideas, but he says there's nothing we can recognize in nature. There's nothing that we can find out in nature that tells us whether the universe has a beginning or whether it's eternal. I'm going to take it from scripture. The natural reading of scripture is that the universe does have a beginning, so I'm going to take it from there. But of course, most people are still quite happy with Aristotle after Aquinas as well. So I would say that it cannot be totemic. It cannot be a key doctrine of the Christian faith if it's one that hasn't been believed or discussed or thought about all that much by the vast majority of Christians throughout Christendom. It's not in any creeds or anything like that. But I think the other way we've got to be careful here, you know, because one of my frustrations as a teacher is that sometimes we present science as a sort of fait accompli, or everybody knows what they're doing all the time, and that article you saw in Nature last week is a fact. Real science isn't like that. It's messy. And one of the things that I've tried to do in my teaching is show a bit of the messiness as well. And I actually think that if we do that more, we'll get more scientists, because they'll realise that you can get stuff wrong a lot, or you can go down dead ends a lot. Mm. But I think just to get back briefly to the singularity issue, the idea of general relativity has been backed up by observation, actually measuring things and backing it up. It was general relativity then that led to the initial idea of a singularity, and that's all observational. That's based on observation. Okay, general relativity has been verified. Now, it may still turn out to be not the correct theory, but it was an experimentally backed up theory. And the stuff that we're talking about as alternatives, quantum gravity, they are toy models. my A-level students sometimes get annoyed because they say, well, I've got to do this question, but I've got to ignore air resistance. You know, calculate how far this golf ball gets hit. You can ignore air resistance. Well, we're ignoring a lot more than air resistance when we're building these models. And so all of the models that Phil features in his documentary series, they're toy models. They're not models of a real universe or of our universe. They make vast simplifications. They're speculative. And we're also, when you combine that with the idea that what you're trying to do is get rid of a singularity, then all you've got to do is a bit of creative maths and find some of these alternatives. So, a singularity is still on the table. There's an interesting article written by, if I can find it, Brunnerman and Thiemann. They say they've done an analysis of loop quantum cosmology. And they say, concluding, the issue of the presence or the absence of the initial singularity in full loop quantum gravity remains open, because you can study toy models, but you don't know what it's going to look like in the real thing. And then even the pioneer of loop quantum cosmology, Martin Boat, I don't know how to pronounce it.
It's pronounced Boat.
Yeah, thank you. He also makes this point. Look, we're making so many assumptions that we've really got to be careful not to go too far. So he says a large number of models that have been analysed, they ignore a lot of the physics. And his language is stronger than I would use, and probably stronger than Phil would use. But he says, as a consequence, none of the broader claims hold up to scrutiny. So I think we've got to present this messiness. And I think also we should make the distinction that singularities, no one was looking for singularities. They turned up uninvited, whereas solutions that don't have singularities are searched out. They are being looked for. That's where the focus is.
Yeah. And obviously, as Dave said there, Phil, a lot of your videos have centered on kind of alternative theories, that don't require a singularity for how the universe exists and came into being and so on. And to that extent, we could spend the rest of the program, what little time we've got, talking about the singularity. We will try and do something else as well. But for you, are you just simply trying to say, look, the science, there's interesting science elsewhere with different possibilities, but also, I guess, with that proviso that we're looking at simplified models and, universes, this is one way of sketching out the universe, that it could have looked like this if we take into these kinds of considerations. I mean, to what extent does it feel like we can ever get to a real kind of, yeah, this is definitely the way it all happened kind of view of the universe in your opinion, Phil?
Well, we can hope. We know one knows, right? So, but I do think that these aren't just clever math to try and get rid of a singularity. So in loop quantum cosmology, which David mentioned there, they're building the theory. And they built that theory for like 20 years before they ever looked at cosmology. And in cosmology, all models are simplified models. You can't do cosmology without that. So when people say, oh, the universe had a beginning, that's also a simplified model. So it's not like one is and one isn't. And I should also add that Martin is basically taking a view that the Hartle-Hawking model is actually what's implied by loop quantum cosmology. Now, that is a view not shared by most people in loop quantum cosmology. They think that actually from the full theory, there's something called spin foam cosmology, where they take the full theory and they also see that the singularity is resolved. And Martin thinks the singularity is resolved as well. He thinks it's resolved differently to the majority of people working in that field. But there's an agreement there that so Martin thinks it's resolved as well.
Well, now you're on first name terms, obviously, with these people, Phil, but and many people may be losing the track here, but if I can try, and I think where we've got to is what you're now referring to, the Hartle-Hawking model, is what's sometimes called the no boundary proposal, which is a way of kind of, do you want to give a go at explaining it? Because you'll do a better job than me, Phil. But what does that represent in terms of, this was another significant development that Dave mentioned very briefly just at the beginning of the program from Hawking. But what does the Hartle-Hawking model, this no boundary proposal, mean? What is it? And how does that play into this whole question over whether there's a singularity and so on?
Okay. So first off, Dave summed it up reasonably well. It's describing a quantum mechanical wave function of the universe. It's quite a complicated model. And out of all the ones that we've covered in our video, it's the one that I find the hardest to try and explain. and get my own head round. So what I should say is watch our video. We have Hawking and Hartle and Thomas Hertog explaining. But to try and simplify things, what they say is that when you go back to the Big Bang, instead of having three dimensions of space and one dimension of time, you have four dimensions of space and one dimension of time. Four dimensions of space, no dimensions of time. And so you get this sort of rounding off. There's no singularity there. It's a bit weird because it does not go back eternally into the past, but there's no point on this surface that can be identified as the first point because all the points on the surface are equally valid as any other. However, there's some other complicating things, which is actually there's sort of two types of time, one called imaginary time, one real time. And don't mistake that for imaginary meaning fictitious. It's something in mathematics, which people that know mathematics will understand. But bottom line is two types of time. And this rounding off happens in one of those types of time, imaginary time. But in real time, you can also trace the evolution of the universe back. And then you have a sort of bouncing universe. It looks like a sort of hourglass. So that's the sort of brief summary of the model. But bottom line is it's more complicated than that. You could read their book or watch my film, and there'll be a more thorough explanation.
Phil describes it very well, actually. I mean, thank you, Phil. Very helpful indeed. I think that the key here is just as you described it, that when we get to the early universe, we're talking about a whole different way of thinking, not just different theoretical models. And so how the dimension of time effectively fades away and becomes a dimension of space is a particular way of trying to think about these things. And Professor Hawking himself often said that he found it difficult to find a model in the real world to describe what was actually going on at the early universe. So a number of things follow out of this. The first is that you've got to speak the language and trust the language of mathematics. This is one of the great beliefs of physicists, that there is an elegance to mathematics and a power of mathematics to explore those things which go beyond the tyranny of common sense, which actually allows to think about things in a completely different way. I think, secondly, you've got to accept that some of these models, as Dave was talking about, do have the possibility of observational testing, and some of them may not. You may have to decide between different models on the grounds of the subtlety or the elegance or the beauty of the mathematical model. And what Hawking was doing and what we try and represent in the book is that Hawking was doing that by saying, I'm trying to understand the very first moments of the universe. I don't have a consistent model to allow me to do that. But if I did, these would be the type of things that would be important to that kind of model. The use of imaginary time, the use of four dimensions of space. Now, I don't want to undermine Hawking or other people's suggestions on this, because actually when you get to these very first moments of the universe, you have to proceed in this humble, yet trusting in mathematics and trusting in a sense of the deeper laws of physics. And the hope, and Phil mentioned that word earlier, and I want to reinforce that, the hope that there is a way of understanding the early universe. And we go through different models at different times in the history of cosmology. But we all have this hope that there will be some kind of solution that allows us to understand the early universe.
Yeah, I suppose what I'm interested in is you know, what motivations are at stake as well, because is there any sense, Phil, that you get the sense that, that Hawking and other scientists don't like the singularity because of any potential, you know, ways in which it could be used for theistic purposes and so on, or is it just that they just don't believe that that's a satisfactory way of understanding the universe? Because obviously some Christians will latch onto these things and say, that's useful for me trying to prove God. The danger is equally that some scientists might have some kind of a bias against certain explanations because they feel like that that they're not comfortable with some of the, you know, some of the implications of it themselves. But what do you think, Phil?
I mean, I think that everyone has a bias, so we can't escape that. But there are real scientific issues to resolve the singularity, because quantum mechanics and general relativity are our best descriptions of the universe, and there is a real contradiction between them. So what they're trying, I think, is it's not so much, I think most physicists don't care about the religious question, to be honest. That's my experience. They're just not interested. And there are many physicists that are Christians that don't care about whether the universe had a beginning. So in the book, they quote Don Page, and he certainly believes the universe is likely to be eternal into the past, but he doesn't care. He thinks, well, that doesn't matter to God. So I think there's a real scientific problem to resolve the singularity. It's true that we all have our biases, but I don't think that's really what's happening here. I think they want to solve a puzzle, which is how to resolve general relativity and quantum mechanics. And the no boundary proposal, I think, is a very powerful idea. We don't know whether it's right, and it is speculative, but I don't feel that in the book it was treated fairly, and we can go into that if you want.
Well, just briefly, give us a sense of why you don't feel it was quite done justice then.
Yeah, and, so and basically...
How they respond to that.
Yeah, so basically, it's a controversial idea, and it's got a huge number of citations. That tells you, it's got 3,650 citations in the scientific literature for that one paper that Hartle and Hawking wrote. That's a lot. So that tells you scientists are taking it seriously. There's a lot of pros and cons, a lot of going back and forth. And I feel what they did was quote all the negative citations and ignore the positive ones. And the thing that annoyed me the most was that there was a bit where they said Jim Hartle is probably losing faith in the idea because he said, I'm not committed to its truth. And I don't think that represents a losing faith. And I actually wrote to Jim and I asked him, does it represent a loss of faith? And I'll tell you what our conversation was. I quote you. What I said to Jim was, I've always had the impression that the no boundary proposal is exactly that, a proposal to be explored, and theorists are never tied to having faith in their proposals or committed to their truth anyway. So for the authors to take this comment to imply a change of view seems misleading. And he said, this is his reply, he said, if the universe is a quantum mechanical system, it has a quantum state. The no boundary wave function is a promising candidate for that state because coupled with a suitable dynamical theory, it predicts features of a large scale universe that we observe today. I continue to work on that and I'm in accord with your last paragraph. So that's why I read my last paragraph, because he said, he agreed. Yeah. I think there's a misquoting going on there, it creating an impression that the founder with Hawking is losing faith because he said he's not committed to its truth. But I think scientists, when they propose these ideas, they shouldn't be committed to their truth anyway until the data comes back unambiguously, this is reality, and that hasn't happened yet.
Well, there you go. He went to the main man, Dave. He's dobbed you in, frankly. at least it's brought the book to Hartle's attention. But what do you say? I mean, obviously, we're talking about a paragraph in a book here, but what were you trying to say? What was your assumption or your thoughts in terms of what he does currently think about the no boundary proposal?
Sorry, about what Jim Hartle thinks?
Yeah, I mean, what were you trying to express about Jim Hartle's potential, this phrase you used of potentially losing faith in the no boundary proposal?
Well, I mean, I will defer. I'm quite happy to defer to Phil if Phil's got direct contact with him. I mean, one of the terrifying things about committing to paper, or as Phil will know, committing to YouTube, although I suspect a YouTube edit is a lot easier than going back to book, is that, when you write 80,000 words on something, you're going to write a couple of words that might need to be refined afterwards. And I think also when you're writing a book about quantum cosmology, even the 7 months between submitting the manuscript to the publisher and it coming off the print line means that the game might have changed completely anyway. I have skin in the game in terms of whether or not I wanted to back Hawking's no boundary proposal? Not really. I wanted to write a fair description of it. And I tried to speak to plenty of people in the process and pick their brains and read the papers. And like Phil, I'd say it is the most difficult thing that I've ever come across. But I did get an email from Don Page. So we can do this naming thing, which I think is good. For the listeners, he's a former student of Hawking. They then worked together for decades, co-authored, I think, 7 or 8 papers, something like that, and were good friends. He's famously one of the people that Hawking had a bet with. I think Hawking seemed to have bets with pretty much every big hitter out there. And Don Page wrote to me saying, I've greatly enjoyed reading God, Stephen Hawking, and the Multiverse, and I thought you gave a very fair treatment of Stephen Hawking and of his views and explained them clearly. I mean, we are at the mercy, aren't we, of the people who are right at the top of the tree. But I think it is true that the No Boundary proposal was this massive watermark moment, a watershed moment. It changed the game. It's the first genuine attempt at putting quantum mechanics and general relativity together. It may be right and it may be wrong, but this is an area of physics. Quantum gravity is an area where, you know, Sean Carroll and others are saying, look, we don't really know what we're talking about. We're just, you know, we're just having a crack at it. And I think that's really important for it to come across just how complicated and difficult and speculative these are. These are playing around with equations and seeing what happens. Then it's nothing like the kind of physics I do in my lab where we hang a mass on a spring and we see, does the spring get longer by the same amount each time? And we can write down a law. I mean, we just don't even know how to write down a lot of the equations for this stuff, let alone solve them.
David, looked like you wanted to come in and say something.
Yes, just to say, I don't have anybody to quote, I'm afraid, either for or against. But I do have a little bit of experience of working as a cosmologist, not anything as terrific as some of the names that we've been talking about. And I just wanted to pick up one thing, which is that this is not just a place of mathematics. It's also a judgment of scientists. Science is a human activity. And you have a number of people who are providing theories. And partly it's about who they are as people. They have their own backgrounds and interests and cultures. They have their own preferences in terms of how you judge elegance and how you judge that which applies. And there is a sense in which I want to both agree and disagree with Phil on the nature of how scientists relate to scientific theories. Yes, one actually has a humility before the facts, as Huxley used to talk about science as. And therefore, you propose something and you want to see it tested by the evidence. But it's also something that often as a scientist you've given birth to. It's something that, sitting in my son's bedroom, you see grow with years. And you have some belief, some confidence, some emotional attachment to. And science is this very messy activity where you've got a number of personalities as well as the hard data and the theoretical framework. Now, when we come, and Phil rightly said, I mean, the Hartle-Hawking paper is hugely cited. It is one of those moments within the scientific framework where you say that is someone planting a foot in it, and really that's going to be there forever. How people interpret not just the theory, but the way that that theory has given birth to questions, as well as other theories, is a very complicated process. And how scientists talk about their own theories is very complicated as well. And I think for me that's a reminder, not just that science is a wonderful, exciting thing because it's about data, it's about mathematical models, but it's also about real people, real people striving to understand more. And that's not to demean science. That's actually to say it's just brilliant. It's fascinating. And that allows us, some of us, to write books where we occasionally might get it wrong. and for Phil to make such brilliant videos about the views, not just the views of the scientists, but the scientists themselves and their own personal stories.
Well, look, we're nearly out of time, and I just wanted to spend a few minutes in the final segment of our program to talk about ultimately where do we come from, and sort of some of the statements you make towards the end of the book, gentlemen, and Phil's response to that. So if we've time, we'll just finish off with that. So much else that we hope to cover, which inevitably we haven't been able to. But we'll go to our final break and we'll come back as we continue to discuss God, Stephen Hawking and the multiverse. My guests are David Hutchings, David Wilkinson and Phil Halper.
Hello and welcome to the program that brings Christians and non-Christians together with me, Justin Brierley.
For over 10 years as host of Unbelievable, I've listened to objections to faith from the world's leading skeptics. And the most common question I get is, how come you still believe? Unbelievable, the book, is my answer. Telling the story of the show and drawing on hundreds of conversations with atheists and Christians, I explain why I still believe Jesus is the answer to life's deepest questions. Get your copy of Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian, at unbelievablebook.co.uk.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of the show. Always great to hear from new listeners. So just before we go back into the final part of our debate today, a shout out to Garrett Godfrey, who shared with me on Twitter his podcast review. He's evidently recently discovered the show and says, "This podcast is actually from a UK Christian radio show, but the premise of it is quite amazing. Highly regarded for its considerate, humble and gracious posture. This show, hosted on Christian radio, usually has one Christian and one non-Christian discussing a topic. Sometimes it's two Christians with very different positions. What's so refreshing is that it is not a shouting match. It is not a straw man exhibition where they seek out the least qualified non-Christian to make for an easy win. Instead, it's a thoughtful, considerate, polite discussion on the issues between well-educated, well-researched, well-spoken people. Wow. Even if you had no opinion on the episode's topic, it's worth the listen just for the reminder on how folks can get along with each other. This show is a must-subscribe, must-listen show in my book." Thank you very much, Garrett, for that lovely podcast review. It's always worth getting in touch if you have just started listening to the show. I always enjoy hearing about what you make of the program. We'll have more of your feedback, especially towards the end of today's show on last week's program, and some of your thoughts on some of those spring harvest videos that I've been able to put out as well in the last week or so. But for now, let's get into the final part of today's program.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, it's been such a fascinating discussion today. I always love it when I learn a lot in the process of both reading a book in preparation for a show and then having the conversation as well. God, Stephen Hawking and the Multiverse is available now. It's published by SBCK. I'll make sure there are links to the book and Dave and David as well from today's show. And of course, Phil Halper, who's joined us on the program today and his YouTube channel, Skydive Phil. I mean, we've talked, you know, about some of the theories, the singularity, the no boundary proposal and so on. And well done, everyone, for keeping it at a level where we can more or less follow along as non-scientists as well. But, you know, I think that the point you come to near the end of the book, gentlemen, is more about sort of where does this leave us in terms of, you know, the idea that we are created by God ultimately. I don't know, maybe we'll start with you, Phil, just to give a sense of how you felt that was characterized. And again, thank you, Dave and David, for being willing to sort of put yourself in the firing line for this grilling from Phil. But I think you disagreed ultimately, and perhaps unsurprisingly, with their answer to the question of where did we come from then. So do you want to tell us what you felt their answer was, Phil, and then we'll see what Dave and David have to say in response?
Their answer was Jesus, if I remember rightly. There was a lot of scrutiny on the no boundary proposal, and rightly so. It's a controversial idea, and there's, say, a lot of back and forth. And then they proposed Jesus as the answer instead. And I didn't feel like there's a lot of difficult problems with saying that. I mean, trying to reconcile Genesis, which says the stars were created after trees, which says there's a solid dome of the sky, which says, you know, that humans were sort of created, you know, out of dust, which has no mention of billions of years or galaxies or, anything like that. How you reconcile that is very difficult. I'm not saying it cannot be done. I mean, I think it can't be done, but there are arguments to be had about that. And I felt that what they should have done was address that head on. And I was waiting for that. How are you going to square Genesis with Jesus, with science? Because it looks like they're completely different. You know, Genesis has primordial water. Well, science does not think water is primordial. How are you going to square this? And I was waiting to read what they would come up with, because there are some, proposed solutions to this problem. And I didn't feel there was anything. It was just okay. Jesus is the answer.
I mean, perhaps that's the subject for another book at some point, Dave. But what's your, do you want to maybe, I don't know if you can quote from the book, what you actually said in response to that ultimate big question of where do we come from? Is it as simple as Phil put it? Well, Jesus is the answer, essentially.
Pressures of word count, but also the brief of the book really was to interact with Hawking. There are plenty of other books that cover the relationship between Genesis and cosmology. I'm sure you could stick a whole load on the notes to this YouTube, and I'm sure that Phil can get stuck into plenty of them. It wasn't in the brief, but what I think was really interesting and what we decided to finish on is how can it be that you can have two people working in the same field, agreeing on the same data, agreeing on the same laws of physics, and all this sort of stuff. And yet one of them looks at the universe and says, well, God made this. And the other one looks at the universe and says, there's absolutely no need for a God at all. And the two people we picked were Hawking and Page, because they worked so closely together, and also because Page wrote one of the strongest defences of Hawking's model. And so they're not even disagreeing about the start of the universe necessarily. Why have they come to different conclusions? And there's an interesting quote from Page. He says, I personally think it might be a theological mistake to look for fine-tuning and other parts of cosmology as the sign of the existence of God. In other words, I regard the death and the resurrection of Jesus as the sign given to us, that he is indeed the Son of God and the Saviour he claimed to be. So what we're trying to do in that last bit is saying, look, you're going to have to go somewhere else for your evidence. I mean, the analogy that I would give is, imagine that you go with a friend to a zoo, and you both want to know, are there elephants at this zoo? Well, what you could do is go to the gift shop, and you could see whether they sell elephants, right? And someone might say, well, if the gift shop sells elephants, then it's more likely that this zoo has elephants in it somewhere, right? And if it doesn't sell elephants, it's less likely. And so you could make a consistency argument. But if you really want to know whether there are elephants at the zoo, you know, you've got to try and find an elephant enclosure and see if there are any elephants in it. And I think that cosmology on its own ain't going to get you anywhere. And in the same way that Phil feels frustrated when he comes across Christians saying, oh, you know, the universe had a beginning, therefore God. I find myself frustrated when someone says, hey, we've built a model of a universe that creates itself, therefore no God. And maybe Phil could identify with that and say, well, hang on, you can't hang your hat on that. You know, that's about elephants in the gift shop. It's not about elephants in the zoo. And so where else do you look? Well, God, in the Bible, God has said, look, I've revealed myself by actually coming to earth as a human being. And how am I supposed to prove that I've done that? Well, I prove it by doing miracles that nobody else can do. And also by telling everyone that when I die, I'm going to come back to life again 3 days later, and then doing it. And so I think that what I would say to Phil is, I'm sorry if people have given you a hard time by debating the beginning of the universe with you. And I'm sorry if people have given you a hard time for any other reason either. But, you know, what the skin in the game for me is that I want people to find Jesus. I want them to discover that there is a God that made this universe. I do believe that will make their life better now, and I also believe that it will make their life better for eternity. And that's my motivation for writing a book like this, and it's my motivation for coming on and talking to Phil, even though I know he might have more knowledge or more personal contacts than me. You know, I'm not interested in winning an argument about singularity. What I want is for him to find Jesus, and So I just encourage him to go and look for the elephant enclosure and ask about these things like, did Jesus rise from the dead and so on. Let's not get out of the gift shop.
Yeah. Well, I don't think any, you know, Phil, as I know, as someone I've spent time with and been around, I've always found you, Phil, to be exceptionally open to investigating these things and obviously as yet unconvinced, but obviously I've always found you to be a very fair interlocutor. And you know, I've had this treatment from Phil myself, guys. You know, I did a video which Phil roundly criticized, and I changed in when I wrote my book, which he also disagreed with, by the way. I changed one or two things on the basis of some, you know, some conversations I'd had with Phil. But but you know, we're all in this, we're all learning together, and obviously we're all coming out at different perspectives nevertheless at the end of this. Phil, it's been great having you on the show. Thank you very much for having me. It's been really interesting dialogue. Thank you as well, David, for being on. And I mean, just from your perspective, David, what are you hoping, like, a Phil or someone who is a Christian will go away from with this book, if it's not sort of a there is a beginning, therefore God kind of answer, which evidently you're saying is not what you're aiming to do with this sort of a book. What are you hoping is the outcome for the reader, be they Christian or non-Christian, of your book?
I think for the Christian, it's to be excited by science. So there's something about, sometimes Christians are either fearful of science or they want to employ science to back up their own faith, or sometimes insecurity about faith. And really, there's something that both Dave and I share, which is we love science. And we love the scientists involved. We love the data. We love the speculation. We love the debate that we've been having this evening about the various models. And we wanted to use Stephen Hawking and the public profile that he had to say, look, science is something that I believe is a gift from God. Therefore, if you're a Christian, don't use it just for theological purposes, and don't be afraid of it. Enjoy it and listen to science as it is, with all its complexity and its messiness. And I hope that for those who aren't Christians, they might see that here's a way of actually not just holding together science and faith, but actually there are many of us who are passionate about science, and who've used the same rigor, we hope, in exploring issues of the Christian faith, to say, you too can explore it. Now, it's right to make the point that we come to different conclusions. We make different judgments. We do that within science. We've been illustrating that for the past hour or so. But that's also true in Christianity. Christianity doesn't present you with a series of simple equations that convince you that there is one answer. Ultimately, Christianity's claim is that there is a personal God who has revealed God's self within space-time history, supremely in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. And there's something to think about and talk about, debate, and then you need to make a judgment yourself on it. And in a sense, if we can offer that space for people to have this kind of conversation, I'll be glad if that's what the book does.
Well, as I say, there was so much more we could have covered, but haven't had time to. Multiverses and quantum theory and all sorts. Maybe that's one for another show. Maybe we can even do it in person as well.
Maybe we are doing it somewhere else.
Exactly. Probably millions of times over. Great way to finish the show. Thank you very much, all of you, for coming on the line.
Thanks, everyone.
Talking about this. As I say, links in the description from the podcast and the video to the book, where you can find out more about that, and of course to Phil's channel as well. And I do hope you've enjoyed today's show. For the moment, Dave, David, and Phil, thanks for being with me.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Look forward to hearing what you made of today's deep dive into this whole area of cosmology, the Big Bang, Stephen Hawking and such. Do email in unbelievable premier.org.uk, or you can get in touch via the Facebook. That's facebook.com/unbelievablejb. Twitter is @unbelievablejb, and Instagram justin.briley too. Thanks to all those who've been getting in touch in those different ways. I will give you some feedback in a moment to some of the last few weeks of programming, but first of all, shout out to Jonathan Fry. Gets in touch via email to say, I've just discovered the Unbelievable podcast. I'm now an avid listener. Truly appreciate the fascinating range of topics and speakers you bring together. Currently in lockdown in Wellington, New Zealand due to coronavirus. Thought to send an email of appreciation to say thank you for hosting such an interesting and positive podcast. Your ability to bring out the best in the people you interview, despite them having quite divergent views, is truly a gift. And the backlog of podcasts is an amazingly rich resource. Taking from Lewis's book, The Four Loves, charitable is the word I use to describe the nature of the conversations and debates. It's refreshing to hear context and analysis prevail over slogans and soundbites, and encouraging that politeness and decency are the norm when your guests converse and debate the important topics of the day. Thanks again for gifting me and all the other listeners a truly faith-building show. Very best, Jonathan Fry. Thank you, Jonathan. Great to hear from you. Interestingly, since the coronavirus crisis, we've had quite a lot of changes in our programming on Premier Christian Radio. The show now going out actually at a 6 p.m. slot on a Saturday afternoon. And I'm going to be doing a bit more live radio over the coming month or two. So you can catch me from, I think, this Wednesday, probably. Still a work in progress. But I'll be helping to host a live show from 10 a.m. Each day, each morning on Premier Christian Radio with Andrew Phillips. So if you want to listen and hear a little bit more from me during the week, you're very welcome to tune in to Premier Christian Radio from 10 a.m. weekdays, starting from this Wednesday. We'll have a range of interesting interviews, music and much more besides. But of course, Unbelievable will continue to come your way each weekend via podcast, radio and, of course, YouTube, wherever possible. Let's go to some of the other emails that have come in. David Taylor in Kingston on Thames. Lovely to receive this because it's nice to hear that this stuff does get into people's DVD players. We've over the years made a number of DVDs of our Unbelievable conferences. And David wanted to say that he just got round to opening the 2018 Unbelievable conference on DVD that he had lying around. And coronavirus has given him the opportunity to actually watch it, and says, I've been delighted by the excellent quality of all the speakers. I watched Hugh Ross's talk on the Fine-Tuned Universe twice, and will probably watch some of the other ones again as well. Thanks for producing an excellent resource and keeping my mind engaged for many hours of enforced isolation. Sorry that this year's conference has had to be cancelled. So am I, David, but never mind. We are looking forward to, plan is to bring it, that very same theme and as many of those same speakers as possible next year. So look out for that. And if you can come along, even better. You can, of course, find all of the past conferences on DVD and such like, and their availability is there from the Unbelievable webpage. Just go to the link where you can shop for some of the resources from Unbelievable. That's at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Was also delighted to be able to put out some content for Spring Harvest Home this last week. As I mentioned, would have been there in person had it been going on this last week, but they managed to get a lot of the contributors nevertheless to film their talks, you know, in their office, in their spare room, wherever they're doing it from. And I was able to put a couple of talks out, one on the coronavirus itself, why does God allow the coronavirus? And also a talk on how the new atheism grew old, which is my reflections on why I think the conversation has moved on from where it was when Richard Dawkins published The God Delusion. And I have a lot to say about some of the new interesting characters, the Jordan Petersons and Tom Hollands and Douglas Murrays and so on of this world, and what they're adding to the conversation these days. So that's all available over at the Spring Harvest YouTube channel. So if you'd like to get hold of that, feel free to do so. I will be publishing it as well on the Unbelievable YouTube channel in the near future. And I'm sure you'll hear some of it on the podcast in the not too distant future as well. But lovely to hear appreciation from Ruth, who tweeted, appreciated the talk on why doesn't God end coronavirus and mend the world from Spring Harvest. So good to see that response to Stephen Fry again, still so relevant. Yes, I included a bit of an old video now that I did tweeted responding to Stephen Fry's sort of diatribe against God that went viral a few years ago online, and included that on the end of that video. Glad you enjoyed it, Ruth. Andy Cook also said, really enjoyed Justin's talk on God and our current situation. But do you really think I can trust any Christian teaching from a man with such a small background bookshelf? There is certainly a bookshelf hierarchy at Spring Harvest 2020. Yes, I'm afraid I did film that one in front of one of my smaller bookshelves, Andy, as you will have noticed. I have much bigger ones, obviously. It was just my spare bookshelf. It is funny, actually, seeing the insides of so many people's houses now that we're all in lockdown. Yes, so some of the impressive sizes of some of those bookshelves. Tom Wright's, yeah, when I did that a conversation with him, I was impressed. And someone suggested, actually, it would make for a fascinating episode of the Ask NT Wright Anything podcast to simply get him to go through his bookshelf and talk about the books. Hannah Brown got in touch via email. This was so encouraging. Thank you, Hannah. It says, I wanted to encourage you by saying how helpful I found that Spring Harvest 2020 seminar on why doesn't God just stop coronavirus and mend the world. I'm a Christian mum in Bury St. Edmunds, working from home and co-parenting our two little girls with my husband, Adam. We were both brought up in quite conservative churches, but more recently have been part of more charismatic settings. We've never been to Spring Harvest, but saw via Facebook that everything was being streamed this year. I've only ever been taught the more traditional Calvinist view on suffering, although I know Christians who say God doesn't author evil or awful accidents and disasters. I've never really understood how they could think that, but after listening to your talk, it makes a lot of sense. So you've made a real difference to me in a time when our church is grieving the loss of a father to three young children to COVID-19 after an enormous month-long prayer effort. Particularly loved your emphasis on how important it is to be compassionate before intellectual reasoning. I listen to Premier a lot during work journeys, but I'll listen out for your weekend show now I know about it. Thank you, God bless you, Hannah Brown. Hannah, thank you so much. And my condolences to you and your church in the loss of that father to those three young children. Absolutely tragic, but prayers are with you. And as I said in that talk, I do believe God is with us even in those dark, dark times. Thanks to all the others who have been getting in touch as well about that. Mark Tomlinson actually wanted to respond to the interview I had with Professor John Lennox. That went out in a podcast special and is available via the video channel too. Said thanks for the excellent input on that key issue. A few questions that don't seem to be satisfactorily answered for me, though, is how does God want us to pray? And what do we expect God to do? Are our prayers limited to God moving within the situation rather than actually stopping it, given the arguments that this is the way he's set up his world? Maybe this has been covered, but I've listened to both those podcasts and the ones with N.T. Wright, Nicky Gumbel and John Lennox. You did a great job. Pray your mind is a fortress and protectors as you hear lots of challenging views. Mark, thank you very much, Mark. As to what exactly you pray, I think you do pray for God to stop the virus, to heal. I don't think there's anything wrong with doing that, because I do believe God can and does intervene. But I think you do that in the awareness, taking what I call the spiritual warfare view, which is what I was really talking about to a large degree in that Spring Harvest talk, that does not mean that is simply what happens, but that what I do believe is that our prayers do play a part in that spiritual battle, if you like. Now, we're not going to see exactly what that looks like. But what I do believe is that actually our prayers do make a difference, and that we are joining with God, pushing against those spiritual forces of darkness. And of course, it's as much about our practical action as well. We shouldn't sort of necessarily split the two away from each other. We it's about the practical action we take, the prayer we do. And that is what faith is, isn't it? It's both prayer and action. So I hope that's helpful in some way. Inevitably, prayer is a mystery at some level as well. I don't claim to know how it's best to pray. And very often, as Paul says in Romans, God sort of intercedes through us in ways that we can't quite express, through groans, through the way in which the Spirit prays with our spirit in some way. And so for me, prayer is much more than simply just asking God to do things. Appreciated you getting in touch. Let's go to some of your thoughts on last week's debate, the big resurrection debate. That was Jonathan McClatchy and David Johnson. Jonathan McClatchy, of course, well-known Christian apologist, and David Johnson is a skeptic who's been listening to Unbelievable himself for many years and comments frequently over at the webpage.
Dan Livant said, I thoroughly enjoyed this week's episode. McClatchy and Johnson had a lively and engaging discussion. I feel as though Johnson did a great job pointing a spotlight on the weaknesses in McClatchy's approach and arguments. There were two moments which stood out to me. First was McClatchy's statement, lots of weak evidences put together actually equate to very strong evidence. As I believe Matt Dillahunty first pointed out, the plural of anecdote isn't evidence. This is a terribly unsound position to hold. And second was Johnson's response when you summarised McClatchy's position about the post-resurrection citing narratives. Justin, you said, what do you do with that historic piece regarding post-resurrection encounters, David? To which he responded, I don't care. Honestly, history is replete with people who have seen their gods. The tone of Johnson's response highlighted the vapid nature of McClatchy's challenge regarding these claims. They are unverifiable claims in writing which came decades after the fact. Even if we assume that the copies we have are accurate to the originals, they're still just anecdotal stories in biased writings which were intended to convert people. There's little to no grounding to assume they're more than legendary embellishments. Says Dan, and says, thanks again for the fine work you do. Always a pleasure to listen to your show. Glad to hear you and your wife are practicing social distancing. Please stay safe. Well, not from each other, Dan. I mean, we live in the same house, and but yes, certainly from others and around, we've been following all the government guidelines. Yes, plenty to potentially respond to there, Dan, in the way you see these things. I won't do so now because there's lots of opportunity, and Jonathan himself was able to do that on the show. Ryshard Nagorski, I think is the name, got in touch via the Facebook page to say thanks for all you do, Justin. And I'm reading out, first of all, a couple of the more critical responses here. There are some very ones that are very complimentary of Jonathan as well. That I'll read out shortly. So Ryshard says, the unbelievable debates, the ones I've seen and heard, have been models of calm, cultured debate between people who respect each other, however much they disagree. Great admirer of your approach and your guests and the work in sharing the debates. But I write because I was very disappointed with the resurrection debate. This wasn't your fault, Mr. Brierley. It is not the arguments that were a problem, but the way they were delivered. Bayesian probability theory and non-zero probability were just two of the technical areas that were introduced with an apparent assumption that all listeners would be familiar with these. Various points were made with such speed of delivery that it was difficult to take them in. Thank goodness you, Mr. Brierley, were there to stop the speakers on occasion and not only ask for elucidation, but also to summarise in clear language, appropriate for the non-specialist, what the speakers, especially Jonathan McClatchy, had said. Mr. McClatchy is obviously very knowledgeable, but on the evidence of this debate, needs to learn how to present his arguments, speak more slowly, and explain certain concepts. I also thought that he appeared weak in the face of Johnson, which is a pity. I speak as an interested layman who thinks the arguments for believing in the resurrection are, on balance, stronger than those against such belief. But Jonathan McClatchy's failure to counter adequately the main points made by his opponent almost convinced me that it's not so. It's very important for many lay people who have not devoted or don't devote their life to biblical study and theology to see that it is perfectly possible to be highly intelligent and still have faith in God and the claims of Christianity. Thank you very much. Obviously, you felt that there was work to be done on Jonathan's part for explaining his arguments more clearly and slowly. I have to say, Jonathan sometimes does have a bit of a machine gun approach. I think it's because he's got so much in there that he wants to get out as quickly as possible. But he's always been very gracious and open to constructive criticism. So if he's listening to this, I'm sure he will take that on board. But there were lots of also very appreciative comments of Jonathan and critical of David as well. These came in via Twitter. Tyler said, Johnson's arguments that the Gospels are sloppy writing struck me as odd. Sloppy reflects a very subjective or very modern journalistic standard, maybe both. But McClatchy's probabilities weren't that convincing either. Or I'm not smart enough to understand them, you put in parentheses. Mike Riley tweeted, I found David Johnson to have nothing to offer to the conversation except the same old popular level atheist arguments and the popular Matt Dillahunty saying, I don't care. He's not in the same league as Jonathan. And Dean Mays in Australia said, at the point where Johnson said, I don't care, I almost switched off. I stuck with it for the sake of Jonathan. That kind of crass dismissal is one of the reasons why I turned away from atheism. And Todd Gersh said, we can only hope David Johnson is never invited back. That was a truly pathetic performance. Other than Peter Atkins, who at least has academic credentials, I've never heard a guest so closed to inquiry or discussion. He threw a 75-minute tantrum. Completely embarrassing. Okay, so some strong words there for David from Todd. And let's finish with this one from David Campbell Cook. Regular listener and emailer says, I enjoyed the discussion on the resurrection between David Johnson and Jonathan McClatchy. Well moderated, as per usual. But I had the feeling that Jonathan had rather the best of it. He always seemed to have an answer to anything David raised, although David was always articulate and expressed well what a lot of atheists must think. The feeling that Jonathan was winning on points was summed up for me near the end by David raising the fairly peripheral issue of the stone, whether the women found it moved away or saw it moved away. It looked like he was getting a bit desperate, trying to find some chink in Jonathan's armour. David did not seem to have a clear plan of attack. I wondered why he didn't go down the Humean route, attacking the very idea of miracle, or did I miss it? Instead, all he seemed to be doing was nitpicking, searching for some inconsistency in the gospel accounts. David asked, but did not press, why we should believe on the basis of the evidence that we have. I thought Justin had him on the back foot when he asked what evidence would he accept as evidence for the resurrection, and he muttered something about missing records of the Sanhedrin. To my mind, this is the crucial point. If Jesus had been raised from the dead, what evidence would we expect 2,000 years later, with no videos, contemporary newspaper accounts available? And to answer, the answer is, I think, pretty much what we have got. Firstly, accounts from eyewitnesses, varying in details as much as we would expect, with no suspicious conformity suggesting collusion. Second, records of incredible change in followers. Third, records of great impact on surrounding society. Regards, David. Thank you very much. Always great to hear from the unbelievable listeners with your responses to shows. You can get in touch about today's programme. Look forward to hearing your responses, especially if you've maybe got a special interest in science and physics and astronomy and cosmology and so on. So do email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or equally feel free to drop me a message via the Facebook page. It's facebook.com/unbelievablejb, or @unbelievablejb for Twitter, justin.com. Briley on the Instagram. That's all from me for this week. Thank you so much for being with me on today's show. Let me tell you what's coming up next week. Something a bit different for you on next week's show, an ethical debate, as two Christians with very different perspectives join me to talk about the criminalisation of drug use, as we ask, is it time to stop the war on drugs? Peter Hitchens, columnist with the Mail on Sunday, outspoken critic of the UK's approach to drug law, and his book, The War We Never Fought, The British Establishment Surrender to Drugs, all that kind of tells you all you need to know about where he stands on the issue. Christina Dent is the founder of End It For Good. She'll be joining us too. She advocates for decriminalising drug use. She's a lifelong politically conservative Christian out in the USA, but had a radical change of mind, and you'll find out why on next week's show. Plus, because that's a slightly shorter debate than usual, I think I will bring you my coronavirus spring harvest talk as well. Why doesn't God just end coronavirus and mend the world? Be interested to hear your responses to that when we put out on the podcast too. Thank you very much for being with me on today's show. Look forward to seeing you next time. Until then, God bless and stay safe. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.